and his face was serious, intent. "We haven't much time," he said softly. They didn't speak. They straightened the bedclothes in silence, put a clean quilt over the worst of the blood, and laid her on it. William wetted his kerchief from the ewer and cleaned the spatters of blood from her face and hands. He hesitated for a moment, then tore the kerchief violently in two and bandaged her torn wrists, then crossed her hands on her breast. Jamie Fraser was by him then, with a fugitive gleam from the blade of his knife. "For her sister," he said, and bending, cut a lock of the shining chestnut hair. He put this into the pocket of the ragged breeches and went quietly out. William heard the brief creak of his footsteps on the stair and understood that he had been left to make his farewell in privacy. He looked upon her face by candlelight for the first time, and the last. He felt emptied, hollow as a gutted deer. With no notion what to say, he touched one black-bound hand and spoke the truth, in a voice too low for any but the dead to hear. "I wanted to save you, Jane. Forgive me." Chapter 134. Last Rites. Jamie came home just before dawn, white-faced and chilled to the bone. I wasn't asleep. I hadn't slept since he'd left with William. And when I heard his step on the creaking stairs, I scooped hot water from the ever-simmering cauldron into the wooden mug I had ready, half-filled with cheap whiskey and a spoonful of honey. I'd thought he'd need it, but I hadn't any idea how much. "The lassie had cut her wrists wi' a broken bottle," he said, crouching on a stool by the fire, a quilt draped over his shoulders and the warm mug cupped between his big hands. He couldn't stop shivering. "God rest her soul and forgive her the sin of despair." He'd closed his eyes and shook his head violently as though to dispel his memory of what he'd seen in that candle-lit room. "Oh, Jesus, my poor lad." I'd made him go to bed and crawled in to warm him with my body, but I hadn't slept then either. I didn't feel the need of it. There were things that would need to be done when the day came. I could feel them waiting, a patient throng. William, the dead girl. And Jamie had said something about the girl's young sister. But for the moment, time was still, balanced on the cusp of night. I lay beside Jamie and listened to him breathe. For the moment, that was enough. But the sun rose as it always did. I was stirring the breakfast porridge when William appeared, bringing with him a mud-smeared young girl who looked like a lightning-blasted tree. William didn't look any better, but seemed less likely to fall to bits. "This is Frances," he said, in a low, hoarse voice, putting a large paw on her shoulder. "These are Mr. and Mrs. Fraser, Fanny." She was so fine-boned that I half expected her to stagger under the weight of his hand, but she didn't. After a stunned moment, she realized the introduction and gave a jerky nod. "Sit down, sweetheart," I said, smiling at her. "The porridge is almost ready, and there's toasted bread with honey." She stared at me, blinking dully. Her eyes were red and swollen, her hair lank under a tattered cap. I thought she was so shocked that she was unable to comprehend anything. William looked as though someone had hit him on the head, stunning him like an ox bound for slaughter. I looked uncertainly at Jamie, not knowing what to do for either of them. He glanced from one to the other, then rose and quietly took the girl into his arms. "There, Anian," he said quietly, patting her back. His eyes met Willie's, and I saw something pass between them, a question asked and answered. Jamie nodded.
"I'll care for her," he said. "Thank you. She..."
"Jane," William said with difficulty, "I want to bury her, decently. But I think I can't claim her.
Aye, Jamie said. We'll see to it. Go and do whatever you need to do. Come back when you can.
William stood a moment longer, red-rimmed eyes fixed on the girl's back, then gave me an abrupt bow and left. At the sound of his departing footsteps, Francis gave a small, despairing howl, like an orphaned puppy. Jamie wrapped her closer in his arms, holding her snug against his chest.
"It will be all right, Ian," he said softly, though his eyes were fixed on the door through which William had gone. "You're at home now."
I didn't realize that Fanny was tongue-tied until I took her to see Colonel Campbell. She hadn't spoken at all until that point, merely shaking her head yes or no, making small motions of refusal or gratitude.
"You killed my sister," she said loudly when Campbell rose from his desk to greet us.
He blinked and sat back down.
"I doubt it," he said, eyeing her warily.
She wasn't crying, but her face was blotched and swollen as if someone had slapped her repeatedly. She stood very straight, though, small fists clenched, and glared at him. He looked at me. I shrugged slightly.
"She's dead," Fanny said.
"She was your prisoner."
Campbell steepled his hands and cleared his throat.
"May I ask who you are, child, and who your sister is?"
"Her name is Frances Pocock," I put in hastily. "Her sister was Jane Pocock, who I understand died last night while in your custody. She would like to claim her sister's body for burial." Campbell gave me a bleak look.
"I see that news travels fast. And you are, madam?"
"A friend of the family," I said as firmly as possible. "My name is Mrs. James Fraser." His face shifted a little. He'd heard the name. That probably wasn't a good thing.
"Mrs. Fraser," he said slowly. "I've heard of you. You dispense pox cures to the city's whores, do you not?"
"Among other things, yes," I said, rather taken aback by this description of my medical practice. Still, it seemed to offer him a logical connection between Fanny and me, for he glanced from one of us to the other, nodding to himself.
"Well," he said slowly, "I don't know where the body has been."
"Don't you call my sister the body," Fanny shouted. "Her name is Jane."
Commanders, as a rule, aren't used to being shouted at, and Campbell appeared to be no exception. His square face flushed, and he put his hands flat on the desk, preparing to rise. Before he got the seat of his breeches clear of his chair, though, his aide came in and coughed discreetly.
"I beg pardon, sir. Lieutenant Colonel Lord John Grey wishes to see you." "Does he indeed?"
This didn't seem to be welcome news to Campbell, but it was to me.
"You're clearly busy, sir," I said quickly, seizing Fanny by the arm. "We'll come back later."
And without waiting to be dismissed, I more or less dragged her out of the office. Sure enough, John was standing in the anteroom, in full uniform. His face was calmly pleasant, and I saw that he was in diplomatic mood, but his expression altered the instant he saw me.
"What the devil are you doing here?" he blurted, and, glancing at Fanny, "who the devil is this?"
"Do you know about Jane?" I said, grabbing him by the sleeve. "What happened to her last night?"
"Yes, I..."
"We want to claim her body for burial. Can you help?" He detached my hand courteously and brushed his sleeve.
"I can, yes. I'm here upon the same errand. I'll send word."
"We'll wait for you," I said hastily, seeing the aide frown in my direction. "Outside. Come, Fanny." Outside, we found a place to sit on an ornamental bench set in the formal front garden. Even in winter, it was a pleasant spot, with several palmetto trees popping out of the shrubbery, like so many Japanese parasols. And even the presence of a number of soldiers coming and going didn't much impair the sense of gracious peace. Fanny, though, was in no mood for peace.
"Who was that?" she demanded, twisting to look back at the house. "What does he want with Jane?"
That's William's father," I said carefully, Lord John Grey is his name. I imagine William asked him to come.
Fanny blinked for a moment, then turned a remarkably penetrating pair of brown eyes on me. Red-rimmed and bloodshot, but decidedly intelligent.
"He doesn't look like William," she said. "Mr. Fraser looks a lot like William."
I looked back at her for a moment. "Really?" I said. "I hadn't noticed that. Do you mind not talking for a bit, Fanny? I need to think."
John came out about 10 minutes later. He paused on the steps looking around, and I waved. He came down to where we sat, and at once bowed very formally to Fanny.
"Your servant, Miss Frances," he said. "I understand from Colonel Campbell that you are the sister of Miss Pocock. Please allow me to offer my deepest condolences."
He spoke very simply and honestly, and Fanny's eyes welled up with tears.
"Can I have her?" she said softly. "Please?"
Heedless of his immaculate breeches, he knelt on the ground in front of her and took her hand in his.
"Yes, sweetheart," he said, just as softly. "Of course you can."
He patted her hand.
"Will you wait here just for a moment while I speak with Mrs. Fraser?"
He stood, and as an afterthought, pulled a large snowy handkerchief out of his sleeve and handed it to her with another small bow.
"Poor child," he said,
taking my hand and tucking it into the curve of his elbow.
"Poor children. The other girl can't have been more than 17.
We walked for a few paces down a small brick walk between empty flower beds until we were safely out of earshot of both street and house.
"I take it that William sought Jamie's help. I thought he might, though I hoped he wouldn't for both their sakes."
His face was shadowed, and there were blue smudges under his eyes. Evidently he'd had a disturbed night, too.
"Where is William, do you know?" I asked.
"I don't. He said he had an errand outside the city, but would return tonight."
He glanced over his shoulder at the house.
"I've arranged for Jane to be appropriately tended. She cannot be buried in a churchyard, of course."
"Of course," I murmured, angry at the thought. He noticed, but cleared his throat and went on.
"I know a family with a small private cemetery. I believe I can make arrangement for a quiet burial. Quickly, of course. Tomorrow, very early."
I nodded, getting a grip on myself. It wasn't his fault.
"You've been very good," I said. Worry and the lack of sleep were catching up with me. Things seemed oddly non-dimensional, as though trees and people and garden furniture were merely pasted onto a painted backdrop. I shook my head to clear it, though. There were important things to be said.
"I have to tell you something," I said. "I wish I didn't, but there it is. Ezekiel Richardson came to my surgery the other day."
"The devil he did!"
John had stiffened at the name.
"He's not with the army here, surely. I would have..."
"Yes, but not with your army." I told him, as briefly as I could, what Richardson now was, or rather, was revealed to be. God only knew how long he'd been a rebel spy, and what his intentions were toward Hal and the Grey family in general. John listened, his face quietly intent, though the corner of his mouth twitched when I described Richardson's plan to influence Hal's political actions. "Yes, I know," I said dryly, seeing that. "I don't suppose he's ever actually met Hal. But the important thing..." I hesitated, but he had to know. "He knows about you," I said.
"What you are.
I mean that you..."
"What I am,"
he repeated, expressionless. His eyes had been fastened on my face to this point. Now he looked away.
"I see."
He took a deep breath and let it out slowly. John was a distinguished soldier and an honourable gentleman, member of an ancient, noble family. He was also a homosexual,
in a time when that particular attribute was a capital offence. For that knowledge to be in the hands of a man who meant ill to him and his family. I wasn't under any illusions about what I'd just done, with three words. I'd shown him that he was standing on a very narrow tightrope over a very deep pit, with Richardson holding the end of the rope. "I'm sorry, John," I said very softly. I touched his arm, and he laid his hand briefly over mine, squeezed it gently, and smiled. "Thank you." He stared at the brick paving under his feet for a moment, then looked up.
"Do you know how he came by the information?"
He spoke calmly, but a nerve was jumping just under his injured eye, a tiny twitch. I wanted to put my finger on it, still it, but there was nothing I could do. "No." I looked back at the distant bench. Fanny was still there, a small, desolate figure, head bent. I turned my gaze back to John. His brow was creased, thinking. "One last thing. Hal's daughter-in-law, the young woman with the odd name."
"Amaranthus,"
he interrupted, and smiled wryly.
"Yes, what about her? Don't tell me that Ezekiel Richardson invented her for his own purposes."
I wouldn't put it past him, but probably not. I told him what I'd learned from Mr. Jameson. "I told William day before yesterday," I said, "but what with everything?" I waved a hand encompassing Fanny, Jane, Colonel Campbell, and a few other things. "I doubt he's had time to go to Saperville to look for her." "You don't suppose that's the errand he spoke of, do you?" I asked, struck by the thought.
"God knows."
He rubbed a hand over his face, then straightened.
"I must go. I'll have to tell Hal a few things, not that, I don't think," he said, seeing my face. "But obviously there are things he needs to know, and know quickly. God bless you, my dear. I'll send word about tomorrow."
He took my hand, kissed it very gently, and let go. I watched him walk away, his back very straight, the scarlet of his coat bright as blood against the greys and faded greens of the winter garden. We buried Jane on the morning of a dull, cold day. The sky was sodden with low, grey clouds, and a raw wind blew in from the sea. It was a small, private burying ground, belonging to a large house that stood outside the city. All of us came with Fanny, Rachel and Ian, Jenny, Fergus and Masali, even the girls and Germaine. I worried a bit. They couldn't help but feel the echoes of Henri Christian's death. But death was a fact of life, and a common one, and while they stood solemn and pale amongst the adults, they were composed. Fanny was not so much composed as completely numb, I thought. She'd wept all the tears her small body could hold, and was white and stiff as a bleached stick. John came, dressed in his uniform. "In case anyone became inquisitive and tried to disturb us," he explained to me in an undertone. The coffin-maker had had only adult coffins to hand. Jane's shrouded body looked so like a chrysalis, I half expected to hear a dry rattling sound when the men picked it up. Fanny had declined to look upon her sister's face one last time, and I thought that was as well. There was no priest or minister. She was a suicide, and this was ground hallowed only by respect. When the last of the dirt had been shovelled in, we stood quiet, waiting, the harsh wind flurrying our hair and garments. Jamie took a deep breath and a step to the head of the grave. He spoke the Gaelic prayer called the Death Dirge, but in English, for the sake of Fanny and Lord John.
"Thou goest home this night to thy home of winter, to thy home of autumn, of spring, and of summer. Thou goest home this night to thy perpetual home, to thine eternal bed, to thine eternal slumber. Sleep thou, sleep, and away with thy sorrow. Sleep thou, sleep, and away with thy sorrow. Sleep thou, sleep, and away with thy sorrow.
Sleep, thou beloved, in the rock of the fold. The shade of death lies upon thy face, beloved, but the Jesus of grace has his hand round about thee. In nearness to the Trinity, farewell to thy pains. Christ stands before thee, and peace is in his mind. Jenny, Ian, Fergus, and Masale joined in, murmuring the final verse with him. Sleep, O sleep, in the calm of all calm. Sleep, O sleep, in the guidance of guidance. Sleep, O sleep, in the love of all loves. Sleep, O beloved, in the Lord of life. Sleep, O beloved, in the God of life. It wasn't until we turned to go that I saw William. He was standing just outside the wrought-iron fence that enclosed the burying ground, tall and somber in a dark cloak, the wind stirring the dark tail of his hair. He was holding the reins of a very large mare, with a back as broad as a barn door. As I came out of the burying ground, holding Fanny's hand, he came toward us, the horse obligingly following him. "This is Miranda," he said to Fanny. His face was white and carved with grief, but his voice was steady. "She's yours now. You'll need her." He took Fanny's limp hand, put the reins into it, and closed her fingers over them. Then he looked at me, wisps of hair blowing across his face. "Will you look after her, Mother Clare?"
"Of course we will," I said, my throat tight.
"Where are you going, William?" He smiled then, very faintly.
"It doesn't matter," he said, and walked away.
Fanny was staring up at Miranda in complete incomprehension. I gently took the reins from her, patted the horse's jaw, and turned to find Jamie. He was just inside the fence talking with Masali. The others had come out already and were standing in a cold little cluster, Ian and Fergus talking with Lord John, while Jenny shepherded the children, all of whom were staring at Fanny. Jamie was frowning a little, but at last he nodded and, bending forward, kissed Masali on the forehead and came out. He raised one eyebrow when he saw Miranda, and I explained.
"Aye, well," he said, with a glance at Fanny. "What's one more?"
There was an odd tone to his voice, and I looked at him in inquiry.
"Masali asked me if we take Jermaine," he said, drawing Fanny in against him in a sheltering hug, as if this were a common thing.
"Really?" I glanced over my shoulder at the rest of the family. "Why?" We had all discussed the matter at some length the night before, and concluded that we wouldn't wait until spring to leave Savannah. With the city occupied, there was no chance of Fergus and Masali resuming publication of their newspaper, and with Colonel Richardson lurking behind the scenes, the place was beginning to seem distinctly dangerous. We would all travel together to Charleston, get Fergus and Masali established there, and then the rest of us would go on north to Wilmington, where we would begin to equip ourselves for the trip into the mountains when the snows began to melt in March.
"You told them, Sassenach,"
Jamie said, scratching Miranda's forelock with his free hand, "what the war would be and how long it would last. Jermaine's of an age when he'll be out and in the thick of things. Masali's worried that he'll come to harm, loose in a city where the sorts of things happen that do happen in wartime. God knows the mountains may be no safer." He grimaced, obviously recalling a few incidents that had taken place there. "But on the whole, he's likely better off not being in a place where he could be conscripted by the militia or pressed into the British Navy." I looked down the gravel path that led to the house. Jermaine had drifted away from his mother, grandmother, Rachel, and his sisters, and joined Ian and Fergus in conversation with Lord John.
"Aye, he kens he's a man," Jamie said dryly, following the direction of my gaze. "Come along, Alannan," he said to Fanny. "It's time we all had breakfast."
Chapter 135. Amaranthus, Saperville, January the 15th, 1779. Saperville was difficult to find, but once found, small enough that it was a matter of only three inquiries to discover the residence of a widow named Gray.
Over there.
Hal reined up, nodding toward a house that stood 100 yards back from the road in the shade of an enormous magnolia tree. He was being casual, but John could see the muscle twitching in his brother's jaw.
Well, I suppose we just go up and knock, then.
He turned his own horse's head in at the rutted lane, taking stock of the place as they walked toward it. It was a rather shabby house, the front veranda sagging at one corner where its foundation had given way, and half its few windows boarded over. Still, the place was occupied. The chimney was smoking fitfully in a way suggesting that it hadn't been recently swept. The door was opened to them by a slattern, a white woman, but one clothed in a stained wrapper and felt slippers, with wary eyes and a sourly downturned mouth, whose corners showed the stains of tobacco chewing.
"Is Mrs. Gray at home?"
Hal inquired politely.
"No be of that name here,"
the woman said, and made to shut the door, this action being prevented by Hal's boot.
"We were directed to this address, madam,"
Hal said, the politeness diminishing markedly.
"Be so good as to inform Mrs. Gray that she has visitors, please."
The woman's eyes narrowed. "A new intarnation are you, Mr. Fancy Pants?" John's estimation of the woman's nerve rose considerably at this, but he thought he ought to intervene before Hal started wheezing.
"This is His Grace, the Duke of Pardlow, madam," he said, with maximum politeness.
Her face altered at once, though not for the better. Her jaw hardened, but a predatory gleam came into her eye.
"Elle connaît votre nom," he said to Hal.
"She knows your name."
"I know that," his brother snapped. "Madam."
Whatever he would have said was interrupted by the sudden shrieking of a baby somewhere upstairs.
"I beg your pardon, madam,"
Lord John said politely to the slattern, and seizing her by the elbows, walked her backward into the house, whirled her round, and pushed her into the kitchen. There was a pantry, and he shoved her into this cubbyhole, slammed the door upon her, and, grabbing a bread knife from the table, thrust it through the hasp of the latch as a makeshift bolt. Hal had meanwhile disappeared upstairs, making enough noise for a company of cavalry. John galloped after him, and by the time he reached the head of the stair, his brother was busily engaged in trying to break down the door of a room from which came the siren shrieks of a baby and the even louder cries of what was probably the baby's mother. It was a good, solid door. Hal flung himself at it shoulder first and rebounded as though made of India rubber. Barely pausing, he raised his foot and slammed the flat of his boot sole against the panel, which obligingly splintered but didn't break inward. Wiping his face on his sleeve, he eyed the door, and, catching the flicker of movement through the splintered panelling, called out,
"Young woman, we have come to rescue you. Stand well away from the door."
"Pistol, please," he said, turning to John with his hand out.
"I'll do it," John said, resigned. "You haven't any practice with doorknobs."
Whereupon, with an air of assumed casualness, he drew the pistol from his belt, aimed carefully, and shot the doorknob to pieces. The boom of the gun evidently startled the room's inhabitants, for a dead silence fell. He gently pushed the stem of the shattered knob through the door. The remnants of the knob thunked to the floor on the other side, and he pushed the door cautiously open. Hal, nodding his thanks, stepped forward through the wisps of smoke. It was a small room, rather grimy, and furnished with no more than a bedstead, dresser, stool, and washstand. The stool was particularly noticeable, as it was being brandished by a wild-eyed young woman clutching a baby to her breast with her other hand. An ammoniac reek came from a basket in the corner, piled with dirty clouts. A folded quilt in a pulled-out drawer showed where the baby had been sleeping, and the young woman was less kempt than her mother would have liked to see, her cap askew and her pinny stained. Hal disregarded all matters of circumstance and bowed to her.
Do I address Miss Amaranthus Cowden? He said politely. Or is it Mrs. Gray?
John gave his brother a disparaging look and turned a cordial smile on the young woman.
Viscountess Gray, he said,
and made a leg in courtly style.
Your most humble servant, Lady Gray.
The young woman looked wildly from one man to the other, stool still raised, clearly unable to make head or tail of this invasion, and finally settled on John as the best, if still dubious, source of information.
"Who are you?"
she asked, pressing her back against the wall.
"Hush, darling."
For the baby, recovered from shock, had decided to grizzle. John cleared his throat.
"Well, this is Harold, Duke of Pardlow, and I am his brother, Lord John Grey. If our information is correct, I believe we are, respectively, your father-in-law and your uncle by marriage." "And after all," he remarked, turning to Hal, "how many people in the colonies do you think there could possibly be named Amaranthus Cowden?"
"She hasn't yet said she is Amaranthus Cowden," Hal pointed out.
He did, however, smile at the young woman, who reacted as most women did, staring at him with her mouth slightly open.
"May I?"
John reached forward and took the stool gently from her unresisting hand, setting it on the floor and gesturing her to take a seat.
"What sort of name is Amaranthus, may I ask?"
She swallowed, blinked, and sat down, clutching the baby.
"It's a flower," she said, sounding rather dazed. "My grandfather's a botanist."
"It could have been worse," she added more sharply, seeing John smile.
"It might have been Ampelopsis, or Petunia."
"Amaranthus is a very beautiful name, my dear, if I may call you so,"
Hal said, with grave courtesy. He wiggled a forefinger at the baby, who had stopped grizzling and was staring at him warily. Hal pulled his officer's gorget off over his head and dangled the shiny object close enough for the child to grab, which he did.
"It's too large to choke him," Hal assured Amaranthus. "His father and his father's brothers all teased on it." "So did I come to that."
He smiled at her again. She was still white-faced, but gave him a wary nod in response.
"What is the little fellow's name, my dear?" John asked.
"Trevor," she said, taking a firmer hold on the child, now completely engrossed in trying to get the demi-lune gorget, half the size of his head, into his mouth. "Trevor Gray."
She looked back and forth between the Gray brothers, a frown puckering her brows. Then she lifted her chin and said, enunciating clearly,
"Trevor Wattiswade Gray, Your Grace."
"So you are Ben's wife."
A little of the tension left Hal's shoulders.
"Do you know where Ben is, my dear?"
Her face went stiff, and she clutched the baby tighter.
"Benjamin is dead, Your Grace," she said, "but this is his son. And if you don't mind, we should quite like to come with you."
Chapter 136 Unfinished Business. William shoved his way through the crowds in the city market, oblivious to the complaints of those rebounding from his impact. He knew where he was going and what he meant to do when he got there. It was the only thing left to do before leaving Savannah. After that, it didn't matter. His head throbbed like an inflamed boil. Everything throbbed. His hand... he'd probably broken something, but he didn't care. His heart, pounding and sore inside his chest. He hadn't slept since they'd buried Jane, would likely never sleep again, and didn't care. He remembered where the warehouse was. The place was almost empty. Doubtless the soldiers had taken everything. The owner hadn't had time to move out of reach. Three men were lounging by the far wall, sitting on the few remaining casks of salt fish, and smoking their pipes. The smell of tobacco reached him, a small comfort in the echoing cold fishiness of the building. "James Fraser," he said to one of the loungers, and the man pointed with the stem of his pipe toward a small office, a sort of shed attached to the far wall of the warehouse. The door was open. Fraser was seated at a table covered with papers, writing something by the light that fell through a tiny barred window behind him. He looked up at the sound of William's footsteps, and seeing him, put down his quill and rose slowly to his feet. William came forward, facing him across the table. "I have come to take my farewell," William said very formally. His voice was less firm than he liked, and he cleared his throat hard.
"Aye, where is it that you mean to go?"
Fraser was wearing his plaid, the faded colours muted further by the dimness of the light. But what light there was sparked suddenly from his hair as he moved his head.
"I don't know," William said, gruff. "It doesn't matter."
He took a deep breath.
"I wish to thank you for what you did, even though..."
His throat closed tight. Try as he might, he couldn't keep Jane's small white hand out of his thoughts. Fraser made a slight dismissive motion and said softly,
"God rest her, poor wee lass."
"Even so," William said, and cleared his throat again.
"But there is one further favour that I wish to ask of you."
Fraser's head came up. He looked surprised, but nodded.
"Aye, of course," he said, "if I can."
William turned and pulled the door shut, then turned to face the man again.
"Tell me how I came to be."
The whites of Fraser's eyes flashed in brief astonishment, then disappeared as his eyes narrowed.
"I want to know what happened," William said, "when you lay with my mother. What happened that night? If it was night," he added, and then felt foolish for doing so.
Fraser eyed him for a moment.
"You want to tell me what it was like, the first time you lay with a woman?"
William felt the blood rush into his head, but before he could speak, the Scot went on.
"Aye, exactly. A decent man doesn't speak of such things. You dinna tell your friends such things, do you? No, of course not. So much less would you tell your father, or a father his..."
The hesitation before father was brief, but William caught it. No trouble. Fraser's mouth was firm, though, and his eyes direct.
"I wouldna tell you, no matter who you were. But being who you are..."
"Being who I am, I think I have a right to know." Fraser looked at him for a moment, expressionless. He closed his eyes for an instant and sighed. Then opened them and drew himself up, straightening his shoulders.
"No, you haven't. But that's not what ye want to know in any case," he said. "You want to know, did I force your mother? I did not. You want to know, did I love your mother? I did not."
William let that lie there for a moment, controlling his breathing till he was sure his voice would be steady.
"Did she love you?"
It would have been easy to love him. The thought came to him unbidden and unwelcome, but with it his own memories of Mac the groom, something he shared with his mother. Fraser's eyes were cast down, watching a trail of tiny ants running along the scuffed floorboards.
"She was very young," he said softly. "I was twice her age. It was my fault."
There was a brief silence, broken only by their breathing and the distant shouts of men working on the river.
"I've seen the portraits," William said abruptly, of the 8th Earl, her husband. Have you?"
Fraser's mouth twisted a little, but he shook his head.
"You know, though, knew. He was 50 years older than she was."
Fraser's maimed hand twitched, fingers tapping lightly against his thigh.
"Yes, he'd known. How could he not have known?"
He dipped his head, not quite a nod.
I'm not stupid, you know,
William said, louder than he'd intended.
Didn't think you were,
Fraser muttered, but didn't look at him.
I can count, William went on through his teeth. You lay with her just before her wedding. Or was it just after?
That went home. Fraser's head jerked up and there was a flash of dark blue anger.
I wouldn't deceive another man in his marriage. Believe that of me, at least.
Oddly enough, he did. And in spite of the anger, he still struggled to keep in check. He began to think he perhaps understood how it might have been.
She was reckless.
He made it a statement, not a question, and saw Fraser blink. It wasn't a nod, but he thought it was acknowledgement and went on more confident.
Everyone says that. Everyone who knew her. She was reckless, beautiful, careless. She took chances. She had courage.
It was said softly. The words dropped like pebbles in water, and the ripples spread through the tiny room. Fraser was still looking straight at him.
Did they tell you that, then? Her family, the folk who kent her?
No, William said, and felt the word sharp as a stone in his throat. For just an instant, he'd seen her in those words. He'd seen her, and the knowledge of the immensity of his loss struck through his anger like a lightning bolt. He drove his fist into the table, striking it once, twice, hammering it, till the wood shook and the legs juddered over the floor, papers flying and the inkwell falling over. He stopped as suddenly as he'd started, and the racket ceased.
"Are you sorry?" he said,
and made no effort to keep his voice from shaking.
"Are you sorry for it, damn you?"
Fraser had turned away. Now he turned sharply to face William, but didn't speak at once. When he did, his voice was low and firm.
"She died because of it, and I shall sorrow for her death and do penance for my part in it until my own dying day. But..."
He compressed his lips for an instant, and then, too fast for William to back away, came around the table and, raising his hand, cupped William's cheek, the touch light and fierce.
"No," he whispered. "No, I am not sorry."
Then he whirled on his heel, threw open the door, and was gone, kilt flying. Part 9. The world may come to an end, but love and music will endure. Chapter 137. In the Wilderness, a Lodging Place. I couldn't stop breathing. From the moment we left the salt marsh miasma of Savannah, with its constant fog of rice paddies, mud, and decaying crustaceans, the air had grown clearer, the scents cleaner. Well, putting aside the Wilmington mudflats, redolent with their memories of crocodiles and dead pirates, spicier and more distinct. And as we reached the summit of the final pass, I thought I might explode from simple joy at the scent of the late spring woods, an intoxicating mix of pine and balsam fir, oaks mingling the spice of fresh green leaves with the must of the winter's fallen acorns, and the nutty sweetness of chestnut mast under a layer of wet dead leaves so thick that it made the air seem buoyant, bearing me up. I couldn't get enough of it into my lungs.
"If you keep gasping like that, Sassenach, you'd like to pass out," Jamie said, smiling as he came up beside me. "How's the new knife, then?"
"Wonderful. Look, I found a huge ginseng root, and a birch gall, and..." He stopped this with a kiss, and I dropped the soggy gunny sack full of plants on the path and kissed him back. He'd been eating wild spring onions and watercress, plucked dripping from a creek, and he smelled of his own male scent, pine sap, and the bloody tang of the two dead rabbits hanging at his belt. It was like kissing the wilderness itself, and it went on for a bit, interrupted only by a discreet cough a few feet away. We let go of each other at once, and I took an automatic step behind Jamie, even as he stepped in front of me, hand hovering within reach of his dirk. A split second later, he'd taken a huge stride forward and engulfed Mr. Weems in an enormous hug.
Joseph, a harich kimmer a how.
Mr. Weems, a small, slight elderly man, was swept literally off his feet. I could see a shoe dangling loose from the toes of one stockinged foot as he groped for traction. Smiling at this, I glanced round to see if Rachel and Ian had come into sight yet, and spotted instead a small, round-faced boy on the path. He was perhaps 4 or 5, with long, fair hair, this flying loose around his shoulders.
Rodney?
I asked, making a hasty guess. I hadn't seen him since he was 2 or so, but I couldn't think who else might be accompanying Mr. Weems. The child nodded, examining me soberly.
You be the conjure woman,
he said, in a remarkably deep voice. Yes, I said, rather surprised at this address, but still more surprised at how right my acknowledgement of it felt. I realized at that moment that I had been resuming my identity as we walked, that step by step, as we climbed the mountain, smelling its scents and harvesting its plenty. I had sloughed off a few layers of the recent past and become again what I had last been in this place. I had come back. Yes, I said again. I am Mrs. Fraser. You may call me Granny Fraser if you like. He nodded thoughtfully, taking this in and mouthing, Granny Fraser, to himself once or twice as though to taste it. Then he looked at Jamie, who had set Mr. Weems back on his feet, and was smiling down at him with a look of joy that turned my heart to wax.
Is that himself?
Rodney whispered, drawing close to me. That is himself, I agreed, nodding gravely.
Eden said he was big,
Rodney remarked, after another moment's scrutiny. Is he big enough, do you think? I asked, rather surprised by the realization that I didn't want Rodney to be disappointed in this first sight of himself. Rodney gave an odd sideways tilt of his head, terribly familiar. It was what his mother, Lizzie, did when making a judgment about something, and said philosophically,
Well, he's a lot bigger than me, anyway.
Everything is relative, I agreed. And speaking of relatives, how is your mother? And your, father? I was wondering whether Lizzie's unorthodox marriage was still in effect. Having fallen accidentally in love with identical twin brothers, she had, with a guile and cunning, unexpected in a demure 19-year-old Scottish bondservant, contrived to marry them both. There was no telling whether Rodney's father was Josiah or Keziah Beardsley, but I did wonder.
Oh, Mammy's breeding again,
Rodney said casually.
She says she's a-going to castrate Daddy, or Da, or both of them, if that's what it takes to put a stop to it.
Ah, well, that would be effective, I said, rather taken aback. How many sisters or brothers have you got? I'd delivered a sister before we'd left the ridge, but...
One sister, one brother.
Rodney was clearly growing bored with me and stood on his toes to look down the path behind me.
Is that Mary?
What? Turning, I saw Ian and Rachel navigating a horseshoe bend some way below. They vanished into the trees even as I watched.
You know, Mary and Joseph are flying into Egypt,
he said, and I laughed in sudden understanding. Rachel, very noticeably pregnant, was riding Clarence with Ian, who hadn't troubled to shave for the last several months, and was sporting a beard of quasi-biblical dimensions, walking beside her. Jenny was presumably still out of sight behind them, riding the mare with Fanny and leading the pack mule. That's Rachel, I said, and her husband Ian. Ian is himself's nephew. You mentioned Aidan. Is his family well too? Jamie and Mr. Weems had started off toward the trailhead, talking 16 to the dozen about affairs on the ridge. Rodney took my hand in a gentlemanly way and nodded after them.
We best be going down. I want to tell Mam first,
afore Opa gets there.
Opa? Oh, your grandfather. Joseph Weems had married a German lady named Monica soon after Rodney's birth, and I thought I recalled that Opa was a German expression for grandfather.
Yeah?
Rodney said, confirming this supposition. The trail meandered back and forth across the upper slopes of the ridge, offering me tantalizing glimpses through the trees of the settlement below. Scattered cabins among the bright flowered laurels, the fresh-turned black earth of vegetable gardens. I touched the digging knife at my belt, suddenly dying to have my hands in the dirt, to pull weeds.
Oh, you are losing your grip, Beecham, I murmured at the thought of ecstatic weed-pulling, but smiled nonetheless.
Rodney wasn't a chatterbox, but we kept up an amiable conversation as we walked. He said that he and his opa had walked up through the head of the pass every day for the last week to be sure of meeting us.
"Mam and Mrs. Higgins have a ham saved for you for supper,"
he told me, and licked his lips in anticipation.
"And there's honey to have with our cornbread. Daddy found a bee tree last Tuesday sennet, and I helped him smoke 'em, and..."
I replied, but absent-mindedly, and after a bit we both lapsed into a companionable silence. I was bracing myself for the sight of the clearing where the big house had once stood, and a brief, deep qualm swept through me, remembering fire. The last time I had seen the house, it was no more than a heap of blackened timbers. Jamie had already chosen a site for a new house and had felled the trees for it, leaving them stacked. Sadness and regret there might be in this return, but there were bright green spikes of anticipation poking through that scorched earth. Jamie had promised me a new garden, a new surgery, a bed long enough to stretch out in, and glass windows. Just before we came to the spot where the trail ended above the clearing, Jamie and Mr. Weems stopped, waiting for Rodney and me to catch up. With a shy smile, Mr. Weems kissed my hand and then took Rodney's, saying,
"Come along, Roddy. You can be first to tell your mam that himself and his lady have come back."
Jamie took my hand and squeezed it hard. He was flushed from the walk, and even more from excitement. The colour ran right down into the open neck of his shirt, turning his skin a beautiful rosy bronze.
"I brought you home, Sasnach," he said,
his voice a little husky.
"It will be the same, and I canna say how things will be now, but I've kept my word."
My throat was so choked that I could barely whisper,
"Thank you."
We stood for a long moment, clasped tight together, summoning up the strength to go around that last corner and look at what had been and what might be. Something brushed the hem of my skirt, and I looked down, expecting that a late cone from the big spruce we were standing by had fallen. A large grey cat looked up at me with big, calm eyes of celadon green, and dropped a fat, hairy, very dead wood rat at my feet.
"Oh, God," I said, and burst into tears.
Chapter 138. Fanny's Frenulum. Jamie had sent word ahead, and preparations had been made for our coming. Jamie and I would stay with Bobby at Amy Higgins, Rachel and Ian with the McDonalds, a young married couple who lived up the ridge away, and Jenny, Fanny and Germaine would bide for the nonce with Widow McDowell, who had a spare bed. There was a modest party thrown in our honour the first night, and in the morning we rose and were once more part of Fraser's Ridge. Jamie disappeared into the forest, coming back at nightfall to report that his cache of whiskey was safe, and brought a small cask back with him to use as trade goods for what we might need to set up housekeeping once we had a house to keep again. As to said house, he'd begun the preparations for building a new house before we had left the ridge, selecting a good site at the head of the wide cove that opened just below the ridge itself. The site was elevated, but the ground there fairly level, and thanks to Bobby Higgins's industry, it had been cleared of trees, timber for the framing of the house laid in stacks, and an amazing quantity of large stones lugged uphill and piled, ready to be used for the foundation. For Jamie, the first order of business was to see that his house, or the beginnings of it, was as it should be, and the second was to visit every household on the ridge, hearing and giving news, listening to his tenants, re-establishing himself as the founder and proprietor of Fraser's Ridge. My first order of business was Fanny's frenulum. I spent a day or two in organizing the various things we had brought with us, in particular my medical equipment, while visiting with the various women who came to call at the Higgins's cabin. Our own first cabin, which Jamie and Ian had built when we first came to the ridge. But once that was done, I summoned my troops and commenced the action.
"You may put the poor lass off drinking whiskey for good,"
Jamie observed, casting a worried look at the cup, full of amber liquid, sitting on the tray next to my embroidery scissors.
"Would it not be easier for her to have the ether?"
"In one way, yes," I agreed, sliding the scissors point first into a second cup, this one filled with clear alcohol. "And if I were going to do a lingual phrenectomy, I'd have to. But there are dangers to using ether, and I don't mean merely burning down the house. I'm going to do just a phrenotomy, at least for now. That is a very simple operation. It will literally take 5 seconds. And besides, Fanny says she doesn't want to be put to sleep. Perhaps she doesn't trust me." I smiled at Fanny as I said this. She was sitting on the oak settle by the hearth, solemnly taking note of my preparations. At this, though, she looked at me abruptly, her big brown eyes surprised.
"Oh, no," she said. "I trust you. I just want to see."
"Don't blame you a bit," I assured her, handing her the cup of whiskey. "Here, then. Take a good mouthful of that and hold it in your mouth. Let it go down under your tongue for as long as you can." I had a tiny cautery iron, its handle wrapped in twisted wool, heating on Amy's girdle. I supposed it didn't matter if it tasted like sausages. I had a fine suture needle, threaded with black silk, too, just in case. The frenulum is a very thin band of elastic tissue that tethers the tongue to the floor of the mouth, and in most people, it is exactly as long as it needs to be to allow the tongue to make all the complex motions required for speaking and eating, without letting it stray between the moving teeth, where it could be badly damaged. In some, like Fanny, the frenulum was too long, and by fastening most of the length of the tongue to the floor of her mouth, prevented easy manipulations of that organ. She often had bad breath because, while she cleaned her teeth nightly, she couldn't use her tongue to dislodge bits of food that stuck between cheek and gum or in the hollows of the lower jaw below the tongue. Fanny gulped audibly, then coughed violently.
"That's strong," she said, her eyes watering.
She wasn't put off, though, and at my nod took another sip and sat stoically, letting the whiskey seep into her buccal tissues. It would, in fact, numb the frenulum, at least a bit, and at the same time provide disinfection. I heard Aidan and Germaine calling outside. Jenny and Rachel had come down for the operation. "I think we'd better do this outside," I said to Jamie. "They'll never all fit in here."
"Not with Oglethorpe."
For Rachel's belly had made considerable strides in the last few weeks, and was of a size to make men shy nervously away from her, lest she go off suddenly, like a bomb. We took the tray of instruments outside and set up our operating site on the bench that stood by the front door. Amy, Aidan, Ori, and wee Rob clustered together behind Jamie, who was charged with holding the looking glass, both to direct light into Fanny's mouth to assist me, and so that Fanny could indeed watch what was going on. As Oglethorpe precluded Rachel being called into service as a back brace, though, we reshuffled the staff a bit, and ended with Jenny holding the looking glass, and Jamie sitting on the bench, holding Fanny on his knee, his arms wrapped comfortingly around her. Germaine stood by, holding a stack of clean cloths, solemn as an altar boy, and Rachel sat beside me, the tray between us so that she could hand me things.
All right, sweetheart, I asked Fanny.
She was round-eyed as a sun-stunned owl, and her mouth hung open just a little. She heard me, though, and nodded. I took the cup from her limp hand. It was empty, and I handed it to Rachel, who refilled it briskly.
Mirror, please, Jenny.
I knelt on the grass before the bench, and with no more than a little trial and error, we had a beam of sunlight trained on Fanny's mouth. I took the embroidery scissors from their bath, wiped them, and with a pledget of cloth, took hold of Fanny's tongue with my left hand and lifted it. It didn't take even 3 seconds. I'd examined her carefully several times, making her move her tongue as far as she could, and knew exactly where I thought the point of attachment should be. 2 quick snips, and it was done. Fanny made a surprised little noise and jerked in Jamie's arms, but didn't seem to be in acute pain. The wound was bleeding, though, suddenly and profusely, and I hurriedly pushed her head down so that the blood could run out of her mouth onto the ground and not choke her. I had another pledget waiting. I dipped this quickly into the whiskey, and seizing Fanny's chin, brought her head up and tucked the pledget under her tongue. That made her emit a stifled, "Oi!" But I cupped her chin and shut her mouth, adjuring her sternly to press down on the pledget with her tongue. Everyone waited breathlessly while I counted silently to 60. If the bleeding showed no sign of stopping, I'd have to put in a suture, which would be messy, or cauterize the wound, which would certainly be painful. 59, 60, I said aloud, and peering into Fanny's mouth, found the pledget substantially soaked with blood, but not overwhelmed by it. I extracted it and put in another, repeating my silent count. This time the pledget was stained no more. The bleeding was stopping on its own.
Hallelujah, I said,
and everyone hooped. Fanny's head bobbed a bit, and she smiled very shyly.
Here, sweetheart, I said, handing her the half-filled cup. Finish that if you can. Just sip it slowly, and let it go onto the wound if you can. I know it burns a bit.
She did this rather quickly, and blinked. If it had been possible to stagger sitting down, she would have.
I'd best put the lassie to bed, aye?
Jamie stood up, gently holding her against his shoulder.
Yes, I'll come and see to it that her head stays upright, just in case it should bleed again and run down her throat.
I turned to thank the assistants and spectators, but Fanny beat me to it.
Mrs. Fraser? She said drowsily.
The tip of her tongue was sticking out of her mouth, and she looked cross-eyed toward it, astounded. She'd never been able to stick her tongue out before, and now wiggled it to and fro, like a very tentative snake testing the air. She stopped then, contorting her brow in a fearsome expression of concentration, said,
Thank you.
Tears came to my eyes, but I managed to pat her head and say,
You're very welcome, Frances.
She smiled at me then, a small, sleepy smile, and the next instant was asleep, her head on Jamie's shoulder, and a tiny drooling line of blood trickling from the corner of her mouth onto his shirt. Chapter 139. A Visit to the Trading Post. Beardsley's Trading Post was perhaps no great establishment by comparison to the shops of Edinburgh or Paris. But in the back country of the Carolinas, it was a rare outpost of civilization. Originally nothing but a run-down house and small barn, the place had expanded over the years. The owners,